Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to IJ's Live Call. I'm Melanie Hildreth. I'm pleased to be here with IJ President and General Counsel Scott Bullock, who will be hosting our conversation. We're joined today with by IJ Senior Attorney Tim Keller and IJ Senior Attorney and Managing Vice President Burt Gall. Today, we'll be discussing Espinoza versus Montana Department of Revenue, IJ's upcoming case at the U.S. Supreme Court in defense of educational choice. We'll be taking live questions from listeners at the end of the call. If there's something you'd like to ask, you can press star on your phone at any time and you'll be added to the queue. Scott, why don't you kick off the conversation?
Thanks, Melanie. Well, during our last call, we promised to give an in-depth overview of an upcoming case with the potential to really dramatically change the landscape for educational choice. And as Melanie mentioned, that case is Espinoza, which the court agreed to hear during its last day of its term in June of this year. And this case is really the culmination of almost 30 years of IJ's work on this topic. And I'm very pleased that we have with us today two of IJ's top legal experts on choice. As Melanie mentioned, Managing Vice President Burt Gall and the leader of our school choice team, Tim Keller. So I'd like to kick off the discussion today by going over some of the key legal decisions with respect to educational choice that brought us to our current case before the Supreme Court, because I think it's important to give the listeners a little bit of context. And this is an area that it's sometimes easy to get lost in the weeds, but I think if we talk about some of these previous cases, it will really frame the issue that's before the Supreme Court in Espinoza. So I'd like to kick off that discussion with really talking about one of our most important cases in educational choice that was an IJ victory back in 2002, and that's the Zelman case that addressed the constitutionality of the Cleveland School Choice Program and addressed this federal constitutional question. Burt, if you could just talk and remind people a little bit about Zelman.
Sure. Zelman really is a landmark case, under the Establishment Clause, but a landmark case for school choice generally. That involved, as you said, Scott, Cleveland's school choice program that had been passed by the state of Ohio. Cleveland just had terrible public schools at the time, very poorly performing. And to respond to that, the Ohio legislature passed a school choice program that allowed parents to select schools, whether they be public or private, or religious or non-religious schools, for their children. But opponents for school choice, as they always do, challenged the program and said it was unconstitutional under the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment. They said that was because religious schools were allowed to participate in the program and parents would choose them. Originally, the opponents of school choice won, but the case went all the way up to the Supreme Court, in which we participated in the litigation, and the Supreme Court ruled 5-4 that school choice programs do not violate the Establishment Clause, do not violate the First Amendment, as long as they are neutral, which means you can choose from among religious and non-religious options, and as long as parents are able to exercise true, genuine choice. They're making the decisions, not a bureaucrat. And with that established, that's where we begin.
And that's where we remove this very large federal constitutional cloud over choice programs.
Yeah, the Establishment Clause had until that time had been the biggest club that opponents of school choice used to bash school choice programs, but Zelman got rid of that.
Let's talk next about a case where we further cemented the constitutionality of choice in a follow-up case that was decided in 2011 called the Wynn case, which we did, in fact, win at the at the U.S. Supreme Court. And Tim, could you just talk a little bit about, give a brief recap of that case and what it meant to choice?
Oh, it would be my pleasure, Scott. So in 2011, IJ took a surprise second trip to the U.S. Supreme Court to defend Arizona's school choice program. And Arizona's program is a little bit different than the program that was at issue in Zelman. Arizona involved a scholarship tax credit program. So under the Arizona program, donors are permitted to donate to private scholarship organizations and receive a tax credit for their donation. And then the scholarship organizations turn around and award scholarships to families to attend the school of their choice. And we had thought after Zelman, we had cleared the deck for the Establishment Clause issues and that this test of religious neutrality and private choice would ensure that there would be no more federal constitutional challenges. But the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals surprised us and struck down the Arizona program because some of the scholarship organizations operated along religious lines. So there was a Jewish tuition organization, a Catholic tuition organization, as well as totally non-religious organizations that, you know, might support Montessori schools or just scholarship low-income kids. And so we got a chance to defend school choice once again in the U.S. Supreme Court, and we secured a really important victory because the U.S. Supreme Court said that tax credit programs are not subject to constitutional challenge because they involve private funds. No matter how you slice it, it's private donors donating to privately established scholarship organizations, and it's parents making an independent choice of what school they want to send their child to. And then we were really able to leverage that decision in state courts all across the country in the tax credit context to show that that tax credit programs in particular are funded by private rather than public dollars.
Yeah, these are charitable dollars like people give to any kind of nonprofit organization.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And as a result, you know, the Montana case also involves a tax credit program, right, which we'll get into in a little bit, which gives us another interesting twist, another opportunity in the U.S. Supreme Court to defend school choice.
Great. Well, we'll talk about two other cases before we get to the case of the day, the Montana case. But again, these cases are important, even though they weren't IJ cases, kind of setting the context in which the Montana case arose. And the first case, I'll kick it back to Bert to discuss, was a case called Locke versus Davey from 2004, decided by the Supreme Court, that I think it's fair to say was a narrow case, but caused some confusion among the lower courts and how it's been interpreted since that time. Can you talk about that, Bert?
Absolutely, yes. Locke v. Davey did cause, to say the least, a lot of confusion in the courts, and it's confusion that we hope that we'll be able to clear up with our Montana case. But after Zelman, it was clearly established that, you know, school choice programs do not violate the Establishment Clause. But looming was this question of, okay, if a state can have a program, can it exclude religious options from such a program? Locke v. Davey didn't answer the question, but it sure left a mess in its wake. In Locke, Joshua Davey was a student who had been awarded a scholarship to attend college, but that was taken from him. He wasn't able to get it because he was studying for a degree in devotional theology. Basically, he was training to become a minister. And the state of Washington, upon learning this, took the scholarship away. He challenged this removal of his scholarship, and the case went all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court ruled it was a 7-2 decision, if I recall, but a narrow ruling that said, look, Washington can take away this gentleman's scholarship because it has a very narrow, specific, and historic interest in avoiding training for the clergy. That is a very early, historic, you know, anti-establishment clause, you know, establishment interest. And so, you know, the Supreme Court used language that seemed to go out of its way to say this is a narrow opinion, we're not speaking to the broader question. But it wasn't explicit enough because lower courts got confused. Some lower courts said, okay, we're going to read this as a pretty narrow decision. But other lower courts said, oh, wait a minute, the Supreme Court has just said states can just do wholesale exclusions of religious options from programs like this, school choice programs. And so the Supreme Court had tried to act narrowly, but left a lot of confusion in the decision's wake.
Right. And that brings us up to the relatively recent past with a case that a lot of the listeners are familiar with. We've certainly talked about it in our school choice litigation. We've had newsletter articles where we talked about it. That was a case decided by the court in 2017 called Trinity Lutheran. And Tim, could you just talk a little bit about what that case meant and how that case set up our case that's currently before the court?
Yes, Trinity Lutheran was a case we were watching very closely. IJ filed an amicus brief in that case, a friend of the court brief, arguing to the court that the program at issue in that case was unconstitutional, or at least the application of the program in that case. So what Trinity Lutheran was about specifically was a state grant program that reimbursed private schools if they resurfaced their playgrounds using recycled scrap tires. And one of the schools that applied for that grant was operated by Trinity Lutheran Church. And while the school was initially granted the money, once they realized that this was a church-operated school, they quickly rescinded their decision and said, no, you do not get the grant. And so Trinity Lutheran filed a lawsuit in federal court arguing that the state could not discriminate against them simply because they were a religious school. And the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, Federal Circuit Court of Appeals, upheld the denial, citing Locke v. Davie, the case that Bert just discussed, and said that no, under Locke, the states can exclude religion entirely from a state grant program. And the U.S. Supreme Court reversed that decision and held that no, states cannot exclude religious schools simply because they're religious schools from this particular program. The court issued, again, a very narrow decision. In fact, they dropped a footnote that basically said, we'll answer the question of whether a state could exclude religious schools from a school choice program for another day. And for at least the program at issue in Trinity Lutheran, because it discriminated against religious schools in the award of dollars that would simply protect kids from getting scraped knees, banged up elbows, was, quote unquote, odious to the Constitution. That was the language that the Chief Justice used.
So their knees are saved. We, in this call, and probably most of the listeners, had to deal with the concrete playgrounds. The kids at Trinity Lutheran got the recycled tires. And then also, and this is something we're going to talk about in a moment, the Missouri was justifying its decision, not only on Locke v. Davie, but, of course, the state's Blaine amendments then as well.
That's correct. So when the state of Missouri excluded Trinity Lutheran, they pointed to a particular provision in their state constitution, which basically said that there should be no appropriation of public funds in aid of quote-unquote sectarian schools, and that language had a particular meaning that we'll talk about in just a few minutes.
That's right. So that is a great segue into talking about our case, because the court in Trinity Lutheran did put in this footnote saying that we save for another day the issue of how this impacts educational choice programs, and we took them up on that invitation, did the petition in our Montana case, and then the court granted that. We just filed our opening brief in that case, I believe, last month, and it's likely to be argued sometime in early part of the new year. And so, Tim, I'll turn back to you again to just recall for the listeners some of the facts of the case and Montana's program.
Sure. So in 2015, the state of Montana enacted a scholarship tax credit program, offered taxpayers a modest $150 tax credit for contributions to scholarship organizations to fund scholarships for kids in need. And we represented in that case a number of individuals. Our lead client in the case is Kendra Espinoza. Kendra is a single mom who has two daughters who originally attended the public schools. One of her daughters was harassed and bullied in that public school because of her very open and public profession of faith. And so Kendra started looking for additional options for her two girls. And she found that at a school in Kalispell called Stillwater Christian, and that's where she enrolled the two girls. The tuition cost was enormous, and the financial struggle for Kendra was real. She, in addition to working a full-time job as an office assistant, has at times had as many as three jobs, working at night as a janitor to make ends meet, and was really relying on this program to help afford the tuition for her girls. And they are at real risk of having to leave that school if we're not successful in defending the program in Montana. So we took this case all the way up to the Montana Supreme Court, and the Montana Supreme Court surprised us by striking down the program. This was the first time that IJ has ever lost a scholarship tax credit case in a state court. Up to this time, every other court had taken the lead from the U.S. Supreme Court and said that these programs are constitutional because they're privately funded. But Montana took a close look at its Blaine Amendment and said, nope, this program is using essentially public funds. They construed the tax credits to be public funds because money was not, quote unquote, going to enter the state treasury. And said, as such, this program is essentially aiding sectarian schools and therefore must be struck down.
Well, and then that teed up the issue that we've been kind of dancing around a little bit here, but I want to talk about directly and turn the conversation back to you, Bert, and that's these infamous Blaine amendments, where these amendments are kind of dusted off. They've been in state constitutions for a number of years and typically used by the opponents of educational choice, most notably public school teachers unions, to try to strike down program. So you could just remind folks what Blaine Amendments are and how they're used to go after choice.
Sure. Blaine Amendments have a sordid history and origin story. It begins with Senator James Blaine of Maine, a political opportunist who looked around the United States at in the late 19th century and saw that there was just continuing resentment of a lot of Americans toward Catholics, and particularly Catholic immigrants. In the 19th century, you saw a large wave of immigration to the United States from Southern Europe, and most of that was Catholic. And what happened was that you had a clash then over public schooling. Many Catholic families did not want to send their children to the public schools, which were not secular at all. They were very Protestant. They taught religion, but from a Protestant perspective.
Use the Protestant prayer and the Bible. And
there was Bible reading, in school. And so Catholic families objected to this. When they were unsuccessful, they then said, well, how about providing funds for us to have our own Catholic schools? Well, this created more resentment, and there were riots all over the country, if you can imagine. There was even the burning of bishops' homes. It was a very kind of violent, brutal period. This was after the Civil War. And James Blaine looked around, saw this happening. He aspired to be the president of the United States. And so he introduced something, the Blaine Amendment, that he tried to get passed at a federal level. And it said basically that no funds intended for public schooling could ever go to any religious school or institution. He tried to get that passed. The bill passed overwhelmingly in the Senate, but fell just short in the Senate. And you would think, oh, okay, well, it failed. Story over. No, because Blaine had caught on to something. And what happened was that many states followed his lead and included these Blaine Amendments in their own state constitutions. Some states didn't even have a choice. One condition upon their entering the Union was that they adopt Blaine Amendments into their state constitutions. And you had parties like the infamous racist Know Nothing Party, for example, who were agitating for these, for these Blaine Amendments. So they were a total tool of anti-Catholic bigotry. They used the word sectarian. That sectarian at the time was commonly understood to refer to Catholic. I would be embarrassed to rely upon them as a litigator to make my case, but opponents of school choice like James Blaine are opportunists themselves, and they have used these Blaine Amendments in litigation for as long as IJ has been litigating these cases to say, look, our state constitution does not allow these programs because of these Blaine Amendments. Money goes to religious schools. And so we've been battling Blaine Amendments for as long as we've been litigating this. And hopefully in Espinoza, we'll finally rid ourselves of the ghost of Blaine.
Amen. Well, Tim, let's talk about kind of the implications of an IJ victory. I don't want to assume there's going to be a victory, but as you know, we'll do everything to make that possible. But talk a little bit about what a victory in Espinoza would mean.
Well, a victory in Espinoza would mean that any state that sought to enact a school choice program would have to give parents a full range of options, both religious and non-religious, as a part of that program. A state could not exclude religious schools simply because they are religious schools.
It has to be neutral.
And it would be totally neutral. Yeah. And so, essentially what this does is it would remove entirely Blaine Amendments as an obstacle to school choice from coast to coast. Give families a genuine option as to where they want to send their kids, to find the school that's going to best work, that's going to be best suited to meet their child's unique educational needs.
And it will take away this major club that teachers' unions have had to go after.
They use them not only in court once a program is enacted, but they often will trot them out when states are considering legislation right. In the first instance as a means of ensuring the programs are never enacted. And so this will eliminate important arguments in the legislature.
That some legislators use them too.
Exactly.
Yeah, well, it's great. Well, thank you, Tim and Bert, for that discussion. And as I said, we expect the argument to be in this winter, most likely in January. And we will pull out all the stops to win this case and then build on that victory to open up even more opportunities to ensure that parents have access to true educational choice for their kids. And of course, the overarching goal of IJ's choice litigation is the same as in all of our other cases, to protect and defend essential freedoms and to maximize the amount of choices that individuals have, rather than those choices being constrained by government power and mandates. I should also note for the listeners that Dick Comer, who has been an essential part of IJ's choice team, is going to argue the case before the Supreme Court this winter. He retired about a year ago, semi-retired, and we're going to bring him out of retirement, put him before the court, and his folks who know Dick, and he's known throughout the educational choice movement and has enormous respect. There's really no better person than Dick to present this case to the court that's been really, as I said previously, the culmination of the work of IJ, and in particular the work that Dick has been doing for so many years to try to resolve this vital constitutional question.
Thank you, Scott. With that, we'll turn to questions from our listeners. We'll start taking live questions in just a moment. If you're on the line and you want to ask a question, press star on your phone and you will be added to the queue. But before we turn to the live questions, we'll start with one or two that were submitted in advance. We had one from Tom in California who asked, if successful, does this mean for sure or partially that all Blaine amendments will be null and void? From a citizen's perspective, will we have to litigate each state or does this case clear the deck?
Well, I'll take that question, Scott. Melanie. It does not mean that all Blaine amendments will be erased from every state constitution. And it's conceivable there could be valid applications of Blaine amendments, such as the Locke v. Davey type application we discussed earlier. But it does mean a victory in this case would mean that all school choice programs nationwide would have to be religiously neutral and give parents a genuine choice as to where they want to enroll their students. States could not simply exclude religious schools for no other reason than that the schools are religious.
We had another question from Peter in Oregon who asks, which of the justices will be the toughest nut to crack?
Well, that's always difficult to predict, but I think that obviously Justice Sotomayor and Justice Ginsburg, I think, will be the toughest ones to try to bring over to our side. Interestingly enough, I think Tim had mentioned that the Trinity Lutheran case was just decided two terms ago, was a 7-2 decision. And Justices Breyer and Kagan were actually in the majority in that case. And they have taken an approach on these issues that really does emphasize religious neutrality as well. And they seem to think that that's an important concept as it is to the Constitution. Will they be willing to go so far as to apply that to choice programs that could have a big impact upon these programs throughout the country? We'll have to wait and see, but we're hopeful that the arguments we're making will appeal to them, and I think that they should have some tough questions for the state and in this case, as they did in Trinity Lutheran.
We will take our first live question. Remember, if you have a question, go ahead and press star, and we'll add you to the queue. This is Mike in California. Mike, you are live.
Hi. I am not really aware of the history of choice litigation, but I'm wondering if it ever has been or even could be argued that public funds to non-religious advocacy type schools is no different than public funds to religious schools. It's still the case that people, public funds so-called, are going from people who don't agree with the type of school and their tax money still being used. So what's the difference? And kind of connected to that on the public funds issue, has it been argued that it's not really public funds, it's just people getting their tax money back, so it's not the establishment issue is kind of ill-conceived. I'm curious about the history of that.
I'll take this one. You know, first of all, yes, I mean, in the tax credit context, you know, we have always argued and usually successfully that these are not public funds. They don't enter the public treasury. And so that is an argument that the vast majority of state courts, you know, have accepted and said, look, these are private funds. It's absurd, you know, to think of this money as being public money and even subject to these Blaine amendments. Now, when you turn to vouchers or publicly funded scholarship programs, you know, it's important to remember that these are not funds that the state is sending to schools. These are funds that are being directed by the choices of parents. And that's something that we always emphasize as well. There would be a problem with direct funding of schools where a bureaucrat decides this is where the funding is going to go. It's going to go to this religious school. But that's not what school choice programs are about. They're about being neutral, including religious and non-religious options, and then letting parents make a choice. The point you made about religious and non-religious schools, I mean, that really does tie into this idea of neutrality. When it comes to religious and non-religious options, we don't want, for whatever reason, whatever's being said or taught, for the state to discriminate among those schools. And so we have argued neutrality. Neutrality is the safest thing for the state to have. And it frankly works best for parents and students. It gives them the biggest variety of options. So neutrality has been a big part of our arguments for as long as we've been litigating this issue.
And once these restrictions are removed, it'll be interesting to see how the marketplace for private education evolves too. I mean, a lot of private education, a lot of places, especially smaller spots, are still largely focused on religious education. They're supported by religious institutions, but that's changing in the country. And if there's a more robust choice program, would not be surprised if even more choices are available, including more secular schools within the religious element that has always been a traditional part of private education. When the marketplace is opened up, you know, some new and interesting and innovative different ideas are likely to come into play.
Great. Well, our next question is from Gary in Florida. Gary, you are live. What's your question?
Thank you. Thanks for the background. My question is, should IJ prevail in Espinoza? What will Leviathan's response be to this great victory?
Well, I'll take that. Several years ago, in a public debate in New York, the NEA's attorney said that they would, after we won the Zelman case, they said they would turn away from the Establishment Clause and they would turn to state constitutions, and that they would be willing to pursue any quote-unquote Mickey Mouse procedural tactic to try and halt school choice in its tracks. Certainly a victory in Espinoza will remove the biggest impediment to school choice across the country, but there will certainly still be work to do. After every choice program is enacted, I fully anticipate, you know, the unions will comb their state constitutions, look for opportunities to challenge school choice programs on nitpicky grounds. But IJ is going to be there to continue and push back to defend educational choice, even from the sort of Mickey Mouse procedural tactics that our opponents have trotted out in the past.
All right. Well, one more question that was submitted advanced from Kathy in Kentucky. She said, please advise if there is anything practical that folks can do in their respective states to add impetus to the movement to strike down the Blaine Amendment. We here in Kentucky are in desperate need of school choice, and we want to help students in failing schools. There are many of us willing to take steps to advance this effort. What can we do?
Well, I'll take that again, Melanie. And in fact, with regard to Kentucky, IJ actually is going to have a special focus there this upcoming legislative session. Kentucky seems to have all the right elements to pass a school choice program. They've tried several sessions in a row. And our activism team is actually going to move into Kentucky, not literally, but they're going to go into Kentucky.
pretty much.
And what they're going to do, they're creating a nationwide parent group, and they're going to identify parent advocates, train those advocates to work in the state legislature and to inform legislators about their desire for educational choice programs. And so, like I said, we'll have a special focus there. More generally, letters to the editor, op-eds, a real focus on parent outreach, education, training, and advocacy is crucial. And then, of course, just raising public awareness about cases like Espinosa, you know, whether it's hosting town hall events with state policy groups, inviting IJ attorneys out to talk, organizing opportunities in state legislatures and work sessions leading up to the session to talk about the impact of the case, going on talk radio and letting folks know about it as well. All of those things are in the realm of really educating the public and state legislators as to the importance of this case and the impact it will have in each individual state.
All right. With that, we're out of time for today. Thanks again to Scott, Bert, and Tim, and for everyone on the phone for joining the discussion. If you missed any part of this conversation, we will have links to an audio recording of the call available next week on our website. If you have a question or any comments that we weren't able to get to, just stay on the line and you can leave a message. So you can also email me directly. We'll be sure to get back to you. If you do leave a message, just leave your full name and we'll be sure to respond. Thank you again for your support for IJ, and have a great evening.